Hey everybody, it's Mary Lou Tyler. We're going to do our best today to eliminate what we're hearing as background noise next to my house in California. There's some hammering going on just in time for this podcast. But we're going to persevere, and I want you guys to meet Carmen Perry. One thing that he just said to me while we were kind of getting ready for this podcast was, the funnel is fundamentally flawed. The thinking about the funnel is fundamentally flawed. And you know what? I 100% agree with him. So I want him to come on the show today and talk to us about the funnel, about the way we think about the funnel. Because let's face it, predictable revenue spoiled everybody in thinking there's this ubiquitous number of leads out there that we can weed through and segment and get down to the 8 to 10 great opportunities per month. But in reality, not everybody has that many list records to actually work on. So Carmen is the co-founder of Kula Partners. He primarily works with manufacturing companies, but that doesn't matter because what matters is he's working with companies that have a finite number of accounts. Either they're growing their base with new products or existing products, or they are doing some net new, but by no means is that the main breadwinner for the company. Carmen, welcome to the podcast.
Mary Lou, it's a pleasure to be here. And I've got to say, look, our timing's impeccable with the hammering noise in the background. So with any luck at all, we'll persevere.
Yes, I will hopefully get my team to kind of weed out, as I said, that frequency where the hammering is going.
Man, so we've teed them up now for a challenge.
Yes, we've got them all ready to go. So let's start with the funnel. Let's start with what gets you so excited about the work that you do, in B2B manufacturing, but it's really, I want the audience to not turn off their heads now, and say, oh, well, it's manufacturing. No, what it is all about is trying to get a finite number of clients, either net new business or existing business that's growing the base. So what got you focused on this part of that whole scenario in the sales process?
So for the listeners, no need to turn off at the notion of manufacturing. We're really talking here about complex B2B sales scenarios, which frankly have a lot of similarities even to smaller professional services organizations. I mean, I say that as somebody who does sales for our agency, of course. So I see more similarities than differences. I guess what, Mary Lou, what got me kind of on about this is that I feel like, as you kind of mentioned in the intro, that this funnel thinking has got us, it's kind of predicated on a number of tactics and activities at the top of funnel that are intended to drive people further down the funnel via BANT qualification, et cetera, to MQL, SQL, and beyond. And kind of the base kind of assumption in all of that is that the top of funnel is unlimited. And for a good number of the clients that I work with, that's just not the reality. They maybe have 20 or 30 clients or customers, that buy from them currently, and a good year is, adding 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. So if you're in that kind of a scenario, chances are you should be able to define a list of 200 organizations or so that you need to be talking to, not 2,000, not 200,000. So in some ways, I feel like the promise of scale that comes with digital marketing is somewhat out of whack with the business reality of a lot of people. And I would say that's the same for my own agency, as an example. We're a marketing agency focused on helping manufacturers transform their sales and marketing apparatus. Well, that right there is a fairly finite universe of people that we can serve. We ought to mm-hmm. be able to define who that is, not just spray and pray with proper SEO.
Right, right. And, this is service industries. A lot of my clients that have long sales cycles. If it's even sports, I do some work in the sports area where they're trying to get the luxury box seats filled. Those are a finite number of people that can fill those seats. So it's anything that you think, wow, I can't sell to everybody. I can only sell to a segment. And segmenting is actually the way of the world nowadays, because with all of the new legislation for email conversations and things, GDPR being one example, we have to be more segmented in our approach, more personalized in our approach. So what you're talking about with us today is all about the process of doing that and how to set that. One thing you said in the intro before we got on live was that you're turning the funnel sideways. Can you help us understand what that means?
Yeah. I feel probably as we both have this conversation and it's exclusively audio, and then we'll start speaking with our hands trying to describe it. And of course, nobody can see this. But if you can imagine just tilting that funnel, just kind of tilt it left. So that funnel now looks like an arrow pointing right. And then tack on an arrow pointing left on the other side of that and make it into a diamond. I think in some ways that's the buying journey that we ought to be imagining our universe of prospects on. And it starts with a human that we can identify at the front end of that, not this. I like the diamond kind of drives that point home in my view, that it starts at one person, not at a limitless number of hundreds of thousands. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, I think most of those prospects in these complex B2B scenarios are moving from a point in their life where they don't even perhaps even know that they need what it is you sell. And they move from there through needs discovery, initial research, et cetera. And then they get to a point where they're actually going to make some sort of purchase decision. They engage their internal stakeholders and procurement and whatnot. And then they begin to move down that convergent side of the diamond, down to what we traditionally think of as that funnel. And that's when they become kind of visible to sales, if you will. The procurement, the RFP has been sent out, requests for information or what have you have been distributed. They've taken some sales meetings. But when we look at when that prospect is actually most open to influence, when can we most introduce opportunity for greater margin, enhanced value, et cetera, how can we frame the discussion, or when are they most open to that? It's in that point when they actually don't even know that they need what it is we sell. And that's at the point when they're invisible to our sales organizations, if we're thinking about BANT. Mm-hmm. And that's when, so it's kind of just strikes me as this this really contradictory thing where we have our best people engaged in conversations that are actually in some ways the least open to influence.
Right. And so, you know, what is a typical process or planning or assessment for us to be able to start these conversations almost like stealthy? I'm sitting here with a blanket over my head for those of you who are wondering why I sound like I'm in a tunnel now. And I'm trying to get this hammering under control. But my question is more related to the stealthiness of having conversations with people and reaching them in their head, where they're at in their head. I mean, how do we go about that? Where do we start?
Well, okay. So if we start from the point of view of we don't need an unlimited number of prospects, we don't have an unlimited number of prospects, but what we need are 100 to 300 or what have you relationships that we need to build. And then at some point, those people become open to considering what it is we buy. Right. Or what it is we sell, sorry. So if we think about it that way, then I think it kind of changes a lot of how we might approach it from a marketing and sales kind of combined approach. How do we get salespeople more involved in some of that marketing function that's more and more up funnel, if you think of it in that traditional sense, but moving down to that down the diamond in the model that I've tried to introduce here. How do we get salespeople engaged in dialogue with our prospects at a point when they perhaps don't even know that they need what it is we sell? I think that there's some great examples of how to do that. I think, frankly, we're on one right now. I think podcasts are a great way to do that. You can connect with prospects and get them onto a podcast and develop a relationship with them in the lead up to having them on your show, and frankly, transition that into a sales relationship 6 months, 12 months down the road. You can kind of get introduced to them in a way through creating marketing with them. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be a podcast, of course. I think there are lots of different ways to do content networking. But it's funny, we rarely see salespeople particularly engaged in that. They, there's in these larger organizations that I work with, manufacturing organizations, they're just quite resistant to doing that. It's kind of like the purview of the marketing department if it's the purview of anyone.
Right. I was just going to say that some of it is culturally within the company itself saying, no, that's a marketing function and you shall not cross over into doing that, which is a disservice sometimes because a lot of times the salespeople become almost experts in a certain area of the field, whatever they're selling. So if they had the ability to write blog posts, to do webinars, to, you know, maybe under the guidance of marketing, but actually to deliver them outside of marketing, I think a lot of this, what you're talking about, would actually be beneficial for those folks who are trying to get these and woo these early clients and potential clients into that funnel. And that's the problem. Marketing is built in so many companies to cast the wide net. And it's hard to get them to think individualized or personalized or hyper-personalized.
And it's running counter to the fact that buyers, especially for my clients in this B2B space, are becoming more and more and more technical. Mm-hmm. And they're demanding salespeople to be more technical, and the salespeople that are rising to that challenge can really benefit from their enhanced technical knowledge if they can actually meet with prospects on that level earlier in the process, via the content networking that we talked about before. Now, I believe it was actually Mary Lou, on one of your earlier shows, you had interviewed Tony Hughes. Mm-hmm. And I think he mentioned a stat that 75% of the deals are won by the organization that first provided education or insight into the problem.
Yes.
Not to slight marketers, but marketers are often less capable of providing that level of education and insight into a highly technical situation. You know, very often the sales organization would be better suited. I think we need to break down those barriers between them and begin to think of this as a more continuous whole. If we want a seamless customer experience from the earliest stage of prospect identification all the way through to customer delight, if we want that to be seamless, we need to take the seams out of our organizations too.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so hard sometimes, especially if I'm sitting here listening to this, it's like marketing doesn't want to let go. I mean, it would be very difficult for us to even do a pilot project in some companies to say, hey, let's let the sales folks build a campaign, high touch campaign, personalized in nature, outside of the marketing umbrella. You know, it's an uphill battle. I've been doing this now for 30 some odd years, and there's a lot of resistance, especially in the larger companies, to be that nimble, to allow sales to do some of the traditionally chartered marketing activities. How do you get around that?
Well, the first thing you do is embrace what you just said and say the good news is if it was really easy, everybody would be doing it, and then there'd be less advantage for us getting it right. Mm-hmm. I think there's some positive inherent in that. And frankly, I'm not sure that I guess what I hear from the marketers that I work with every day is a pretty healthy appetite for collaboration with the sales organization.
Wow.
Thirst for it in some way.
I'm not seeing that, but that's just my world.
Yeah, it's funny. I have actually found in my in the podcast that we have, I've had we interview manufacturing marketers every week, and there have been times when I admit where I've tried to characterize the marketing and sales relationship as being more hostile than it actually was in reality. Like, wow. You know, the guest kind of called me on it. And I think I've been called on it enough now that I believe them.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I mean,
so hopefully you start to see it soon too, Mary Lou.
I don't know. I'm very pessimistic about that because I think that's one of the biggest problems that I see is the alignment of marketing and sales and the willingness to let go, even if it's just a small subset. You know, there's always a common denominator here in that we're all trying to get net new business. We want more revenue. But there are some just lines being drawn. Not all companies, but quite a few, where, you know, you have product marketing people who are responsible for the marketing of the product itself. Then you have corporate marketing people who are responsible for the corporate communications. And then there's that marketing message, the brand distinction, brand essence. And that's where if there's a heavy emphasis on brand, it's difficult to get things done and approved so that sales can go and do something. I mean, I've seen it so much that I'm actually hopeful and optimistic now after hearing you say that marketers are not saying that. That's great. But I think people listening in the audience are kind of rolling their eyes right now saying, yeah, that sounds great on paper, but that's not.
Yeah. Well, I think your point around when it starts to impact brand, does that mean sales can kind of get a free license to go off and do what they want? And I don't think that's really probably what we're hoping for here. Right. I guess I've once marketing became at least partially responsible for lead generation, it changed in some way fundamentally the relationship between marketing and sales. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of organizations found themselves for a while just in that dialogue between basically sales saying the leads that marketing are sending them suck and back and forth, right? But I guess I've noticed in the folks that I speak with that there's quite an interest in moving beyond that. I think that traditional dialogue is dying off, but I'm not happy to be proven wrong, but I think if your listeners want to prove me wrong, they can.
Well, and it could be too, you know, you're focused on certain industries and certain industries might be more open to it than others. I mean, that's also another way to look at this. I primarily, you know, I work in healthcare a lot. I do a little bit of manufacturing. I do services, and in all, for the most part, there's a willingness to listen and a willingness to maybe plan, but execution, they want control primarily of the whole process. And so that makes it difficult for even doing such simple things as writing what I call a sales conversation canvas, which is the actual touches, the actual sales conversations that we put inside of a sequence, a multi-touch, multi-channel sequence. But the way I like to approach it is, look, marketing, you're in charge of the assets for sure. And what we'll do is we'll create what we think is a nice one-page wireframe to include with this conversation. But we want you, obviously, to approve it, make sure it's got the right profile, the right, you know, whatever the fonts are, and making sure from a branding perspective that we're not, you know, running solo on that. And that seems to work best. But what happens is if we rely 100% on marketing to write some of that copy for us, you know, we have a different side of things. We're in a persuasive conversation on sales side. We're not in an attraction conversation necessarily all the time. And if we get marketing to do our emails, it's very much attraction based. And sometimes that hurts our conversion rates.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that the people writing sales sequences, things of that sort, need to have had actual contact with the enemy before. They need to have sold something. It's not something that can be done academically. And in fact, when you read a script that's been written by a marketer that's never sold anything, it's obvious. Right. I think there's a danger in creating a separation in anywhere along the line there. We have to find a way through this because where it ends up, you know, if marketing's creating the the bigger chunks of content or whatever that are being referenced within or maybe linked to within those sales emails or what have you. You know, right there so often is the point of disconnect, right? Where you start, you go from a sales conversation that's focused on a prospect's actual requirements to sometimes a marketing conversation that seems like somebody had their head up their arse the entire time they wrote the marketing can be better when they bring sales to the party and vice versa. And I think it's funny because most marketers I talk to would suggest that sales has more power in their organization. So I think it might be a bit of a, depending on what side of this debate you're on, you may have different perceptions color shaping our points of view here.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the beauty of what we're talking about right now is that you're cracking the code in your world. You're able to bring the marketing and sales people together. And I think the way that you describe the task at hand, you know, what the pursuit plan that you're coming up with, because there's a limited number of accounts, by definition, screams for marketing and sales alignment. And I think in that context, that's why you're probably having a lot of success. A lot of times, though, we're working with clients who have the, you know, 2,000 records, but they also have the 200, and it's very difficult for us to spin those different plates, is what I'm saying. So I'm very encouraged by the fact that perhaps all this time we've been presenting the problem incorrectly with the challenge, and that is that we don't have a standard funnel. We have a sideways diamond.
Well, precisely, if you think about how we report on that traditional funnel, I mean, how marketing comes to the table and says how they've been doing in the last quarter, and they talked about things like their top level organic search traffic and things of that sort. We have the technology now to know, yeah, great, what's our digital presence doing in terms of how many people has it attracted from our top 200 target accounts? And what is our conversion rate down through this fictitious funnel that we're talking about of people that are actually within our target cohort versus people that are just showing up at our site for whatever reason? I think that if we can begin to take those marketing metrics and layer on that kind of target account focus in so many of these instances, it can be a really nice point of bringing together the two functions. It can be a real point of them coalescing, I think.
Right. And then, you know, then you apply the magic that you've come up with is to look, this is the scenario, this is the sales conversation canvas to utilize as a kind of recipe for this particular segmented part of the market. Those small number of accounts are whales, are what I call jump accounts. I saw that from one of my clients. You know, when they call, we jump. When they bat an eyelash, we jump, because we want them as clients. And those guys are treated very differently, and we do require more of a handshake and an alignment and a camaraderie between marketing and sales in order to get that conversation started and to push them through gently the pipeline to the point of opportunity and beyond.
Yeah, and I think the extent that we can be successful in engaging people earlier in that process and doing so using the joint forces of marketing and sales, then we can get to a place where we're shaping the purchase process before it happens. We can extract more value. It's not just whether or not we close business, but it's how profitable is the business that we close. Because, you know, so much of it, if the problem happens that the procurement process is standardized without any influence, and then you're just kind of playing the same game as everyone else in that kind of funnel thinking. But I think if the real carrot at the end of all of this is if we can bring together these skill sets, we can actually get into the process earlier. We can overcome the typical failure to position in these kinds of large purchase scenarios. We can overcome the failure so often to frame the purchase process and to control it, you know?
Right, Right. So in your experience then, Carmen, you know, the traditional kind of warm up the chill campaigns that marketing does for, let's just call it the, you know, tier two accounts or tier three accounts, which are the rest of the world, not the whales, the other guys. What changes when we're working with a smaller number of accounts? What channels? Now, I know I'm asking you to be more generalized, but you know, you mentioned something like podcasts. Are there other types of activities that lend themselves for these finite number of accounts? Oh, more often than not, knowing that we have different industries, different verticals, different sales cycles. But you know, the traditional way would be to blast out an email sequence that warmed up the chill. What have you seen in your world that adds more credibility to the actual conversion of these folks and getting them thinking about, wow, I never thought about that, or gee, how do they do that? Or, wow, I think I should spend some time with these people because they're saying some stuff that I hadn't even, wasn't even on my radar. What are those things that you recommend?
Well, so often, I mean, in some ways, and hopefully this answers your question, Mary Lou, but I would say that the Forrest Gump moment, the things that, you know, like peas and carrots that go together here, so often are when you have a finite a group that you can sell to, those same organizations are often very heavily invested in trade shows. That's where they find the finite people that they talk to, right? Basically, just thinking about your marketing this way and who you're selling to this way, you can surround those trade show environments in a much more sophisticated way than what most people are doing now. Whether that's just LinkedIn paid social advertising targeted towards those organizations that are attending that trade show and promoting content in advance of it, promoting your presence there, et cetera. We can just get a lot more focused than where most people are spending their dollars.
You know, another thing that I've done with clients with the trade show in mind is to pre-invite them to, if we can, do a workshop of some sort. You know, it's like a webinar, but a seminar kind of thing. It's free and, you know, we're trying to get butts in seats, so to speak. So we engage people who are, if we can get the list of the attendees, or if we had a list from last year and reached out to the companies. And again, we have our target list, so we should be able to target those people in that list, ask them if they're going to that trade show. Hey, great, you know, we're doing a workshop on this particular topic. We know that you have been interested in something like this. Would you want us to reserve a seat for you? And that gets people to start the engagement process so that the folks that are there know they're coming, have some unique characteristic of their offering that they want to demonstrate, and then more importantly can start engaging in that face-to-face conversation, which is fabulous to get people engaged and wanting to know more about what we do.
Absolutely. And of course, if you have the actual attendee list, that can become a lot easier. When you don't have that, you just simply know the organizations that are likely to be there that you want to be selling to. You can work backwards from that as well. Another missed opportunity tactically that I think is just kind of so obvious is that every trade show is based geographically, right? It actually has a place where it's happening. Right. So you can target mobile advertising within a kilometer or a mile radius from that location. And you can be getting conference attendees that are just like checking the weather on their phone or looking for local restaurants or whatever at lunch, but you can be warming them up that way as well and doing so in a very targeted, very low cost manner.
Yeah, this is great.
Yeah, only a brand halo.
Right, right. What other things besides trade shows have you seen and worked on? How about direct mail? Has that come back for things like this type of segmentation?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we really try to help people think about these more complex processes as also being multi-touch point in terms of the hierarchy of their organization. I think one of the other areas that's underutilized in our space is that many manufacturers, mid-sized manufacturers, are still family-owned, maybe five, six generations on. And the businesses that they typically try to sell to oftentimes can be family owned as well, as an example. It can be a great point of connectivity at the executive level in these organizations that can help grease the skids of any future sales conversation. But it's almost never leveraged that we could actually have our senior, our president, our, you know, our owner actually connect with this person on the basis of we're both fifth generation family business owners, right? Very few, you know, such a, you know, of course they want to engage in that conversation. So that it's something that they would share with so few other people. But it's almost anytime I've uncovered that parallel in a target account list and suggested somebody do that as a way in, they're almost always shocked.
Definitely. And I remember doing, asking the CEO to write a letter. This was for a food company that was based in the Midwest. And we did a split test of him writing it versus the director of marketing writing it. And he overwhelmingly got the higher response rate because people related to the fact that, first of all, I took the time to write a letter, and we did an email campaign actually, but it was almost in the form of a letter of introduction. And it was very successful asking him to do that versus the director of marketing. So I'm with you on that. One more question about this whole manufacturing vertical. I want to see if you also had this experience. The tenure of the sales executive, how long have these guys and gals been in the role of the companies that you service on average?
Way longer than the marketing folks. it's not uncommon to see 40-year veterans, you know.
Yes.
And I've got to say, one of the things that's fascinated with me as I've gotten deeper in my work with manufacturers is that almost, it seems odd, but the marketers almost seem like they're hungrier than the sales folks sometimes. The sales folks have become very, you know, once they've been around for 30 or 40 years, they're farming the pre-existing accounts, and any sense of hunting is long since.
Left the building.
Yeah. And so you have these, sometimes these younger marketers that are hip to bring new leads to the table, and they're kind of almost yelling into the ether. It's been a surprise, but also that can I think the tenure of the sales organization can lead to some challenges in changing it and making it more digitally savvy, as an example. But you know, at the same time, almost every organization that I work with has at least a portion of it that that can be worked with. They're not all 40-year vets.
Right. That, you know, it's interesting because in the last couple of years, I've been asked to speak at conventions and conferences in industries that the average tenure is 20 plus years as a sales rep. And it is frustrating for me because of the fact that even though I'm 61, it's frustrating for me that they're not willing to adopt or just listen to a new way of doing things because they have their Rolodex and they have their way of doing business. And this whole thought of follow-up systems and leveraging technology to help with the conversation is just something they just will not do. And because there's more of them than me, it's very difficult to convince. So what we do is we try, like you said, take the younger guys who might be not at book yet and need to still kind of, you know, do some planting of seeds and get them excited about what we're doing. And then hopefully it'll propagate through. But by no means can we go in and say, this is what we're going to do now, everybody, because it just doesn't work that way. So it's been very frustrating for someone like me who is all about getting everybody in the hunting mode. And it's just not the case in some of these firms. So I like the fact that you ebb and flow and pick the battles where you can to get, and eventually it'll propagate through to those people who really need it and want to grow their business, their book.
An old agency veteran friend of mine once told me, and it stuck, that you can't counsel into no demand. And and man, is that ever true when trying to get an older salesperson who doesn't want to change? But I must say, I have found some success in some of the sales enablement technologies. Like, you know, when they hear that, yeah, you don't worry about CRM right now. Don't worry about tracking your activity or what have you. But this is a way that you can know if your prospect opened the email and is looking at your proposal. You know, sometimes like that type of very simple functionality can deliver a lot of benefit and is enough of an intrigue to get them playing ball.
Right. So, Karen, we're kind of running out of time here. I can talk to you forever about this because this is a mysterious part of the work that I do too. That convincing the cultural it seems that cultural personalities are a big part of finessing through this. And frankly, I'm a process person, and so it's sometimes very difficult. But if someone's listening to this, it's like, you know what? This is sounding like our firm. How do we get started with you? What do we do first?
How do you get started with Krula Partners?
Going down the path of figuring this out. And first of all, do we have those, 20 to 40 accounts, 200 accounts, whatever it is? How do we get to that point? And then what do we need to change in our sequences, our messaging, our sales conversations? So yeah, where do we get started with someone like you with your knowledge in figuring out if this is a good fit for us?
So, look, I think, there could be a lot of different starting points. So I guess I maybe won't answer the question as directly as you might like. But I think quite simply, it's about, I think in some ways, what I find most of my prospects and clients, the shift that they undertake is shifting from kind of this organization-centric mindset in their marketing and sales function, and really fundamentally transforming it to a more human-centered process. They're taking a more human-centered design approach to how they build out their marketing and sales function. So start from extrapolating from those target client profiles, knowing the organizations that we serve, and then unpack that into the actual personas and the actual people. Let's know who is our lead economic buyer and the makeup of that buying committee, and then begin to build our overall marketing and sales framework around that. And I mean, that process from there then tends to unfold from a point of view of creating a digital foundation for that to kind of be launched from, be that a website, beyond that digital trade show presence, et cetera, even things like your factory tours. How do you transform all of those things to make them more centered on the actual people that we're selling to, not talking in this bland organizational speak about superior quality and great service and amazing people in these broad generalities. So, I mean, the way that gets started is it starts by getting grounded in who we're actually building for, and on abstracting that as much as possible.
And what I like to do is look at a simple quadrant, and across the x-axis, the horizontal, I have existing and new. Across the y-axis, I have existing and new. And then I put clients on the x-axis. I put products on the y-axis. Now I have four quadrants. If I'm selling to existing clients with existing products, that's my base. Those are people that I want to continue to have long lifetime value with. And my conversation is going to be very different than the quadrant right next to it, which is new clients with existing products. Those clients need a little bit different conversation. So if you think about it like that, with new and existing products, new and existing clients, and you have four quadrants, find out where you're at and where most of your business is coming from. And that will also help you do what Carmen's saying, unpack from that quadrant. Okay, these accounts are my jump accounts. In those jump accounts, these are the types of people with whom I'm going to have conversation initially, or maybe follow-up conversations with. And as Carmen said, you've got to change your whole attitude of approach to these people from what he even said, factory tours. Who would have thought of that, right? But it makes perfect sense. So you look at all the touch points that you have relating to that buyer profile, and change it accordingly for that particular quadrant. It's not everybody. It's just the people who reside in the quadrant that you're trying to bring more revenue in. And so you're going to have multiple funnels, and some are going to look like Carmen's diamonds, and some are going to look like the regular funnel, but it's not one size fits all. And that's, I think, one of the biggest mistakes people make, is they try to push everybody down the same funnel, and it just isn't like that. Carmen, thank you so much for your time today. I apologize for the next door neighbor hammering, but I think we got through it.
Mary Lou, it's been interesting. I think you've been in the, it sounded like you were in a tunnel a time or two, but with any luck at all, the audio folks will do their magic, and it'll be fantastic.
Yes.
Thank you for having me on the show today.
Wonderful. And I'll put in the show notes, everybody, Carmen's contact information, LinkedIn, et cetera, his website. And he is the co-founder of Cool Partners. So there's a lot of stuff on his website that you can check out independently of the podcast. Thanks again, Carmen. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Mary Lou.